This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the Trump administration's redefining anti-Semitism and shoehorning it into the 1964 Civil Rights Act, where it doesn't belong, in order to suppress free speech on college campuses. We're joined by Norman Finkelstein and Abdin Jabara, two of the most profound thinkers we have in America on these topics. We devote an entire hour of our show to this topic because, as both speakers feel, the Trump administration has gone too far.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In the past several years, support for the human rights of Palestinians has grown substantially, especially on U.S. college campuses. Israel is being criticized and even boycotted for its violation of international law and its treatment of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, which it surrounds militarily, in the territory of the West Bank, which it conquered and now militarily occupies, and in Israel proper, where Palestinians are a discriminated against minority. In response to this growth of support for Palestinians, on December 11th, President Donald Trump signed an executive order changing the 1964 Civil Rights Act and implying for the first time that the 7.5 million American Jews who live here are not a religious group, but instead a nation and a race. The implication of this is that they are an other with dual loyalties, loyal not just to the United States, but loyal to Israel. The dual loyalty accusation is an anti-Semitic trope with an old and ugly history. Presidential advisor Jared Kushner wrote a New York Times op-ed defending his father-in-law's policy, equating anti-Zionism and criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. This was done in order for the Department of Education to suppress the free speech rights of Palestinian solidarity activists on campuses who may now be labeled as anti-Semitic for their activities, and their schools would be denied funds unless the activists were shut down. We talk today with attorney Abdin Jabara, a leader of the National Lawyers Guild and the former president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. We also speak with historian Norman Finkelstein. He is the author of a number of books on Israel, including The Holocaust Industry and The Image and Reality of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Abdin, Norman, welcome to our studio and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Michael.
What do you think of Donald Trump's December 11th executive order changing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was intended then to outlaw racial discrimination, and now implies that Jews are a nation and a race? Why did he do it, and what do you think the implications are for it? Norman, what do you think?
The Trump administration is obviously trying to exploit the anti-Semitism card, both as a payback to some of his donors, most notably Sheldon Adelson, but others, and also because it's proven to be an effective weapon by the right wing internationally, and particularly the anti-Semitism card was played by Boris Johnson and the whole of the British media, not just the Tories, the whole of the British media. The anti-Semitism card was played in order to discredit Jeremy Corbyn personally and the Radical Labour Project in general. How successful it was in the UK is open to question. I happen not to believe it played a critical factor in the defeat of Corbyn. It was Brexit that defeated Corbyn. And the United States, Trump is going to play that card in the coming election against Bernie's supporters. And so this is just part of the attack on the left and on the, we can call it here, the Bernie Project. I think, my opinion, they've wildly overstepped this time because these are basically lunatics, and we shouldn't recoil from using a phrase like that. People like David Friedman before Jason Greenblatt, this prepubescent twit, Jared Kushner, they're maniacs. and they have overstepped this time. And it's a huge opportunity. And it would be a really sad, sad occasion if the opportunity is squandered. This Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act had nothing whatever to do with speech. It's about acts of discrimination. If you're discriminated against in a housing, if you're discriminated against in employment, if you're discriminated against in what we normally understood to be discriminatory acts, then Title VI came into play. It has nothing whatever to do with speech. And now the attempt to shoehorn this anti-Semitism hysteria into Title VI of the Civil Rights Act is so completely insane. And it can cause a real backlash among those who believe in defending free speech in general, and in particular, academic freedom. It could evoke a backlash if we do it correctly. And so I see it, strangely enough, I see this latest intervention by Mr. Trump as a godsend. It's a gift. And if we handle it correctly, I think they can be completely discredited. If we turn it into a sectarian issue of do you or do you not support Zionism, you're going to lose 90% of the audience, that is to say college campuses, because it's directed at college campuses. You're going to lose 90% of the college campus who don't give a darn about Zionism. However, if you turn it into a free speech, academic freedom issue, you can create a huge contingent of people who will not like what this administration is trying to do, which is to silence speech. One of the things I've been reading, Frederick Douglass's biography, autobiographies, he wrote three, I'm reading the third one right now, and it was interesting for me when he talked about the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And he said the Fugitive Slave Act, it was a dead letter. It didn't work because you couldn't enforce it. They couldn't make it enforceable because when what he called the biped bloodhounds, namely the slave trackers who came to try to bring back the slaves, huge crowds would form. You're not taking him back. You're not taking him back. And so you couldn't enforce that law. And we should call this the Fugitive Speech Act. What's called the executive order is really the Fugitive Speech Act. And we should have one test case after another. You keep saying everything they say you can't say now. You hold forums. You hold meetings. You convene conventions on campus and keep testing it and testing it and testing it until they discover you can't enforce it. Because it's such a gross, egregious violation of free speech in general and academic freedom in particular. So now we should seize the initiative and say, you say we can't say that, we're saying it, and try to stop us. You can't win on this. You cannot win on trying to shoehorn this anti-Semitism hysteria into the 1964 Civil Rights Act has no place there. That was about acts, not speech. And even in the executive order, they were careful to say that, of course, we're not going after free speech. Fine, then we're going to test it and see what's going on here. It's a great opportunity if we do it right.
Abdin Jabbar, what was your reaction when you learned of Trump's December 11th executive order?
I agree in large part with what Norman said. I think it is a boon for our struggle. I think it's an opportunity to advance the cause of Palestinian rights. And I see it as a part and parcel of a whole process that has taken place over the past decade. We are now at a juncture, I think, that I never thought would happen, because I never thought I would see in the New York Times posed the question, is Israel a racist state? I never thought I would see that in print. Even raising that issue in print gets people to think. Now, we started years ago, when Joel Covell wrote his book, Overcoming Zionism, discussing this whole issue. And I agreed very wholeheartedly with Norman when he said, the American people don't know what Zionism is. They don't know that Zionism is just another word for Jewish nationalism, that they don't, you don't use the word nationalism, you use Zionism. So we started this committee, as you recall, Committee for an Open Discussion of Zionism. So, but I want to begin by saying that Kenneth Stern, who 15 years ago drafted the definition of anti-Semitism for the American Jewish Committee, has said that right-wing Jews today are weaponizing it. That's exactly what has happened. Since the Trump administration has come into office, he has aligned himself with the most right-wing elements in the Jewish community. And he has given them carte blanche to do what they will in the various departments of government, in the various pronouncements regarding Israel. And he is doing this as an alliance between his white nationalist movement and Zionism. That's the reality of the situation. Now, there's a history to this that precedes even the election of Trump. And it is when, for instance, Breitbart, he went to Israel and he came back and he said he wanted to help Israel. And he started Breitbart News. And Breitbart News, which became literally mouthpiece for this white nationalism, proceeded ahead. There's a history to this, as I said, and the Republicans and the Trumpers have been trying to destroy the Democratic Party in part by denying it funding. And how do they do that? They say the Democrats are soft on anti-Semitism. The Democrats are soft on Israel. And we know that at least 50% of the funding for the Democratic Party comes from Jewish Americans. So that is exactly what they're, and it's not just me saying this, it's this congresswoman from Michigan, Plotkin, said that that's what the real aim is here when they charge the Democrats of being soft on anti-Semitism in Israel. So when I say that I agree with Norman, I think that this is a great opportunity, but what it means is that the resistance has to be elevated. It's exactly right. It has to be on each and every college campus, because the Trump administration has now singled out academia for attack. And that has been the last bastion of some free discussion on this whole issue about Palestine, and it's particularly these Middle Eastern studies. They, in North Carolina, I was there 2 months ago at the National Lawyers Guild Convention, and at Duke University, the Duke University Middle East Studies Center had been singled out by the Trump administration and the Department of Education under Betsy DeVos for being held to account, they said, because they weren't following the guidelines for funding under the National Education Act. And that was because of a function that they held, a Gaza Day function, where some Palestinian rapper was rapping. And as usual, the thought police go out and photograph this and videotape it and so forth, and then they have it translated, and they say he was anti-Semitic. He was talking, making some anti-Semitic remarks. I don't know what was they were. Some congressman in North Carolina complained to Department of Education. They started an investigation, and all of this is part and parcel of this whole attempt to put the kibosh on this these Middle East study centers that have, they understand what the situation is in the Middle East. And they're doing this by saying, we're going to deny you funding for your programming.
I just want to make just a brief aside. Now, I don't understand rap. You know, I'm a different generation. Doesn't compute for me. He said some sentence like, take Mel Gibson and take that. And that's what they plucked. I didn't even know what it meant. You know?
Mel Gibson's an anti-Semite.
I know, but it didn't even say anything about it. Just said, and take Mel Gibson and take that. You know, rap in general is not the most lucid prose, as you know. So when they plucked this one six-word sentence from the rap and turned it into the whole conference was anti-Semitic, I totally agree with Abdin that they're going after the Middle East studies programs and college campuses in general. And it's an interesting thing what happened. For the longest time, these Middle East regional studies programs were pretty tame, and they were controlled by persons like Bernard Lewis. And then roughly around the 80s, 90s in particular, they fell out of the control of the pro-Israel factions. And so what did they do? It's a very interesting story. They basically seceded from the Middle East studies programs and created their own programs. They created this thing called Israel Studies.
Absolutely. It's happened here at NYU. Yeah. They pulled out of the Middle East Studies program.
And they formed their own little propaganda outfits, which are heavily financed by well-endowed Jewish persons. And they create Israel Studies, Holocaust Studies, and then that's appended to what is a legitimate field, namely Judaic studies or Jewish studies. Jewish studies, Judaic studies has a long history, and it's a very reputable field, which has produced very sound scholarship by first-rate scholars. Israel studies, Holocaust studies, this is just Israel studies, pro-Israel studies, you should just call them. And so why did they pull out and create their own little fiefdoms? Because they lost the battle. It was no longer possible within conventional, legitimate scholarship to defend, I hate the word narrative, defend the Israeli propaganda for the past 40 years. And so they pulled out. And once they pulled out and created their Israel studies, Holocaust studies, in addition to the Jewish studies, which I said, I'm going to assist is a legitimate field of intellectual inquiry, then they decide now to try to destroy the Middle East studies programs. And that's what they're targeting. But in general, besides the Middle East studies programs, they know that on college campuses, they lost the battle for public opinion. You cannot any longer prevail in the court of public opinion on colleges and universities. Too much of the truth is now out. And so now that they lost the battle for public opinion, they're carrying on like a mafiosi. They threaten alumni donors who withdraw their money. They threaten all sorts of things. Now they're threatening
administrators, college administrators. That's the ones that are really being threatened because they say, you don't cooperate, we're going to cut off your funding.
That's correct.
That's what they've got. It's a sort of Damocles that they're holding over.
It's that blunt. It's a very blunt instrument. We're going to cut your funding. And now, besides the donors, the alumni donors, they're now going after the federal funds. That's Title VI.
Right.
They're going to try to cut the federal funds to these programs unless you fall into line. So it's a two-prong, let's be honest about it, it's money. It's about money, and it's about significant sums of money. However, as tempting as that money is, you don't want to lose it. there is a principle of academic freedom. And that principle is deeply defended in the academic world, in particular on things like with the Duke University case. You think that this bankruptcy lawyer, David Friedman, or this prepubescent twit, Jared Kushner, is now going to be telling us what we're allowed to have, what books we're allowed to include on our curriculum, or Betsy DeVos? I'll never forget the day when Bernie Sanders, he was interrogating Betsy DeVos, and he turned to her and he said, I don't know, Abdin, if you remember that moment. It's actually priceless. He turned to her and he said, Ms. DeVos, do you think that if you weren't a billionaire, you would be being considered for this position? And this Betsy DeVos is now going to decide what books you're allowed to put on your college syllabus? No, no professor is going to accept that. So I think it's a real opportunity. Turn it into the issue of free speech and academic freedom, and these people will regret the day they came up with this latest little piece of lunacy. They're carrying on like the United States of America is their freaking synagogue. It's not. And you're not going to get away with it this time.
Abdin?
Yes. I just want to say that, you know, at this National Lawyers Guild convention that I attended in Durham, North Carolina, a resolution was passed condemning these efforts by the Department of Education. And we cited the fact that over 60 members of the Jewish studies programs around the country had sent letters and petitions also denouncing this. So this is a coalition of people are involved in academia and who are involved in law and in civil rights work that are working together to make this a failure on the part of the Trump administration.
I would want to emphasize, as Abdin just said, Jewish studies. They're serious. They're serious scholars. And they understand the implications. You're not going to get Israel studies people to sign this. You're not going to get the Holocaust studies people to sign it because they're just working for Israel. They're propagandists. And they were created for that purpose, fiefdoms of propaganda for the state of Israel. But a lot of serious Jewish scholars, and I want to emphasize, that's one important thing we have to do, not turn it into a sectarian issue. It's not about Zionism. It's not about Jews. It's not about anti-Semitism. This is about academic freedom, freedom of speech. We have the right to say what we believe on a college campus. That is the purpose of the college campus, to defend those rights of freedom of speech, academic freedom, as the German expression has it, die Gedanken sind frei, thoughts are free. You are not going to take your synagogue's agenda and now impose it on college campuses. It ain't gonna happen. And for everything they say you can't say, this prepubescent twit now says you have to acknowledge that anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism. You know what's really funny about that? That's what he wrote in the New York Times. You know what's really funny about that? Not even the lunatic IHRA definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance right. Association, not even that definition says that. If you read
this, I disagree with Norman.
I read it on the subway 20 times.
Let me just say
I read it on the subway over and over again this morning on the way here. It doesn't even say it. Now he's taking his own personal agenda and saying the Trump administration says anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism. Well, buddy, maybe you think it, and maybe your other three horses of the apocalypse think it, but it ain't even in that lunatic definition by the IHRA. So we have to say, you say we can't say it? Guess what? We're not only saying it, we're holding a conference on it. Guess what? We're not only saying it, we're going to have a whole freaking week devoted to it. And we're going to test you whether you are going to try to suppress our right to speech. I think it's a great opportunity, A, to make a big coalition, and B, to discuss serious issues. Was Israel's creation a racist endeavor? That, to me, is a serious scholarly issue. And it's a perfectly legitimate topic of a conference, maybe not a week, but, you know, a conference. Here, let's have a serious scholarly discussion on that topic. Was it and is it still a racist endeavor? That's not even for a scholar. That's not even a debatable question. You could say it had other aspects to it. It wasn't just a racist endeavor. But when Israel's leading authority, the leading authority, Benny Morris, he says, quoting him, "The idea of transfer or expulsion, the idea of transfer was built in and inevitable in Zionism." That's his words. The idea of transfer, what we call in current vernacular ethnic cleansing, the idea of transfer was inbuilt and inevitable in Zionism. That makes it a racist endeavor. It may not make it only a racist endeavor, but who would deny that the United States was created as a racist endeavor? Expulsion of the native population, in significant parts, extermination of the late racist population, and the enslavement of the African population. No American scholar would deny that. They would say there are other aspects, they would call it redemptive aspects to it, our founding. But no serious scholar would deny that that was a very significant part of how we came to be. So are you telling me a serious scholar can say that about the United States, but you can't say that about Israel? Is that what this prepubescent twit is telling us now? No, you're not getting away with it. We're not going to let you get away with it. Going too far. You have overstepped.
Abdin, your reaction to what Norman just said?
He said that we should avoid the whole issue of Zionism. That's what I understood what he said earlier. And I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I think this is a learning and a teaching opportunity on the question of Zionism. If Jared Kushner wants to say anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, let's talk about what Zionism is. All right? If he's saying that anti-Jewish nationalism is anti-Semitism, let's talk about that. Let's talk about it and talk about it in a way so that people understand what's at stake here. The other issue that they brought up as being anti-Semitic was to deny the Jewish people the right of self-determination. That was the other thing. It leaves off so much. Right of self-determination where?
I totally agree.
All right. So let's add that to this question. Do Jewish people have a right to determination on the land that's occupied by another people?
I totally agree.
That's the real question.
I totally agree.
So what we have to do is to complete these sentences that they start.
I totally agree.
All right.
Abdin, you know, the door is open.
All right.
You don't have to bang it.
I totally agree. I'm not banging on the door, but I want to make clear that Zionism and what Zionism is on the table, and we've got to keep it there.
Well, are Jews a race or a religion or a nation? All right, what's your opinion on that?
You know something, it's not up for me to say what they are, all right? If they want to be a religion, that's fine. Frankly, I think that Judaism has been hijacked by nationalism. That's what I think.
I agree with you.
Okay? And I think that this nationalism, these people who, they brought all these people from Russia who were just nominal Jews, and they forced them into becoming Zionists. So here's the question. The question is not whether they're a race or any. That's not for me to say. because this whole issue about what about race and ethnicity and so forth is a very complicated one. Anthropologists and sociologists have been dealing with it for centuries. So it's not that's not important. The important thing is no group of people, whatever they are allowed to persecute another group of people because they're different. That is the issue, all right? And that is the issue in terms of the Israeli Jews and the Palestinians. The Israeli Jews do not, whether they're a race or an ethnicity or a religion, do not have a right to persecute another people. If, as you said, that what happened, Isaac Deutscher said that there was a burning building and somebody, the Jews jumped out and fell on somebody. If that is the idea about what happened with regard to the Palestinians, there have been no real attempts to make recompense, to say, I'm sorry that I landed on you. Let me help you get up. Let me help you get to the hospital and get some treatment. Let me get you some remediation. There has been none of that. They have continued to regard the Palestinians not as victims, but as enemies, as people who need to be keep being punished and pummeled. That's what the problem is. The problem is that Zionism cannot do anything different from that. And there are people says that, well, there's a good Zionism and a bad Zionism. But I don't see any form of the Zionism saying we need to make recompense and we need to treat the Palestinians fairly because we have done them harm.
Norman, what was your thinking on that?
I agree with Abdin. This question, what are the Jews? Are they a people? Are they a race? Are they a nation? This question has been going on since the dawn of the Jewish people. And it's a kind of sectarian issue. Let Jews argue about that. They have that right, as any other people, or if they are a people, has that right to debate those things. I don't believe, and I think Abdin basically said it, I don't think we should get sidetracked on those issues. Jews can argue till the end of time what they are, and that's their right, and they've written enough books to fill several libraries on the topic. I think that they have that right. I don't want to engage in that issue. It's never been a major concern of mine. I just wanted to do well in school. I was a good Jewish boy.
And you were a good student.
Right. My mother never asked whether you were a member of a race, religion, or that. How are you doing in school? What are your grades? But I think here we have an overlap. Right now, we have an overlap of two issues. One, there's the free speech academic freedom issue, and that issue has been prompted by the effort to, or triggered by, the effort to suppress criticism of Israel on college campuses. And so we should try to focus on the academic freedom, free speech issue as we have or use as a test case critical issues bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Because so far as we are focusing on critical issues bearing on the real lives of real people, I think as a political act, we should focus on things that mean something to the people of Palestine in terms of trying to mitigate their oppression, their suffering. So, for example, part of the IHRA definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition, is that Israel is a racist, was created out of a racist endeavor and is a racist endeavor. So, you can ask a question. Is the blockade of Gaza a racist endeavor? Is the occupation a racist endeavor? The IHRA says Israel's not a racist endeavor. Well, I think this is. And focus on that and have a day. We want to discuss, is the Israeli blockade, are the Israeli settlements, are they racist endeavors? I think we should focus on concrete, specific issues that affect Palestinians, because as a political movement, I don't see that we're trying to convert or convince anyone about Zionism. I don't agree with Abdin on that. I have to say one of the first lectures I heard from Professor Chomsky is when he said, from the age of 5, I have been a Zionist. Now, when I was 5 years old, I was trying to figure out how to tie my sneaker and how to zipper my pants. Professor Chomsky, at the age of 5, had read the whole corpus on Zionism, resolved that he's a Zionist, and to this day will still tell you he's a Zionist. I don't really quarrel with him about that. I don't really care. I'm more concerned about concrete acts, exactly as Abdin said. I don't care about whether it's a race, a religion, a people. I care about one people oppressing another people. And I think that's what we should focus on. The concrete acts which are inimical to any democratic or enlightened view.
Abdin?
Well, let me just say, in all due respect with regard to Professor Chomsky and to Norman, both of whom I regard as very dear friends, that one unending principle of Zionism is not just return to Zion, but the creation of a Jewish majority state. All right? That is a principle of Zionism, creation of a Jewish majority state. And what does that mean? That means this transfer, this expulsion, this ongoing refugeehood of Palestinians. That is one of the components of Zionism. And if you don't recognize that as being part of Zionism, it is not just some lofty ideal that is not being implemented. It is being implemented day in and day out. And that is the ongoing oppression and expulsion of the Palestinians.
I don't think it's, I will just reiterate, I don't think it's useful politically to get into a debate about what is or isn't Zionism. First of all, because you lose around 99% of your audience, only around 1% are really interested in that question. I think if you talk about its practical effects, an inhuman and illegal, a barbaric medieval blockade of Gaza, 1 million of whom, half of that population, is children, that reaches people. I was at Princeton speaking about a month ago, and I was speaking on the situation in Gaza. There was the usual clique of Jewish crazies who happen to be smart, but that doesn't preclude the fact that they're crazy, a clique of Jewish crazies in the audience, and they thought they had their, so to speak, trump card against me. And one of them stands up, a student, and he says, well, I'm in the IDF. And I'm on the border of Gaza. I'm there. I said, you know, that's the problem with Jews nowadays. You have no shame. You see, Amira Haas, many Israelis have said, Gaza's a concentration camp. Gaza's a concentration camp. So if you're one of the guards along the border of Gaza, that makes you a concentration camp guard. And if I were you, I would kind of be ashamed of being a concentration camp guard. But you come here and you flaunt it. You're proud of the fact that you are guarding against 1 million children where 97% of the water is poisonous, and you're keeping them trapped in that narrow space where the water is poisonous, and you're proud of it. You know, that's a real problem. And if you look at the UN report, a very impressive report put out by four UN people, the most recent one said categorically, Israel is intentionally targeting children, journalists, medics, and people with disabilities, people in wheelchairs or amputees. It's intentionally targeting them even as they pose no threat. That's called murder.
I don't mind a human rights approach to the Palestine issue. That's fine. There are a lot of people who have been doing it. We have done it. The Lawyers Guild has done that. We've sent these delegations and so forth. But you've got to understand that what is happening in the West Bank and what is happening in Gaza is part and parcel of a mindset, all right? A mindset that emanates from the whole philosophy of Zionism. And that is what is going on here. Unless you understand that, Norman used the word mitigate. He wants to mitigate the suffering of the Palestinians.
At minimum.
That's what he said. He used that word, mitigate. I want to end it.
Yeah, I do
right?
too.
I want to end it. And we can only end it unless the Israelis and the Israeli Jews do not continue to receive the support that they receive from all over the world, including primarily from the United States.
Michael Ratner, who, along with me and Heidi Boghossian, founded this program, Law and Disorder. Michael was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he went over on a fact-finding trip to Israel and Palestine. And he came back, and I remember the speech he gave at Judson Church. Michael died 3 years ago, but what he said is really, I think, central to what we're talking about. Michael used to explain that genocide is not confined to a Nazi-type mass murder. And he believed that what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians is a form of genocide. Would you agree with that?
100%. 100%.
Norman, what do you think?
I have, in the course of my political life, come to the conclusion that it's much more effective to describe rather than to label. So I prefer to describe the situation and then let the audience decide for itself what is the situation. So let's take a simple example. Since 2006, Israel has placed Gaza under a blockade. 70% of Gaza consists of refugees, or sons, daughters of refugees and other generations. More than half of Gaza consists of children. That blockade has gone on now for 13 years. The water in Gaza is poisoned. A lot of the soil in Gaza is poisoned. According to the UN, conservative UN organizations, I'm not talking about the UN Human Rights Council, I'm talking about fairly conservative ones, they say by the year 2020, which is imminent, Gaza will be unlivable. Okay? So I said, I would say at this point, I ask you to decide if you're confining a civilian population, half of which is children, in an unlivable space, physically unlivable. What word would you use to describe it? And you figure it out. I'm not going to use a term. I'm going to let you use your moral imagination and your available vocabulary to describe it in a word or in several words. On the question of how you describe Israeli behavior. Abdin says it boils down to Zionism. I think it's many things. I think there is that Zionist ideology. It's a component. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Zionism, so I am familiar with the history, the theory. Yes, it's a component. There's no question about that. It's also the fact there's a large element of just Jewish racism and Jewish superiority. There is an element in Jewish culture, which one has to acknowledge, this sense of Jews being better, Jewish life being more valuable than non-Jewish life. If you look at a lot of the history of the Nazi Holocaust, you would think that what made the Nazi Holocaust so terrible was that Jews were so smart and intellectual. That's why those who write the history don't like to include the gypsies. And there is that element, an element. I didn't say it's the whole of Jewish tradition and history, but that element in its corrupting form of Jewish chosenness, in its corrupting form of Jewish chosenness, plays a part. There is the part played by the fact that Israel was founded as a settler colonial state and in many ways resembles other states. So of that founding, if you compare the history of the native population of the United States with the history of the Palestinians, it's not so dissimilar. I've written extensively on the topic. There's a large room of overlap and commonality and similarity. Is one reducible to the other? No. But are there broad areas of similarity? Yes. And there is the imperialist element, you know, Israel as an offshoot of an imperial power and the way imperial powers carry on against colonial powers. So there are a lot of elements that come to make up why Israel is what it is today, which is, in my opinion, it's a very ugly place with all the veneer of its redemptive qualities, if you believe in that, you know, the kibbutzim and the austere, simple standard of living, which was true of Israel in the 1950s. Its redemptive features have now been completely effaced, and it's an ugly place. It's like the American South before the Civil Rights Movement, a very ugly place. When you read about the lynchings in the American South, which were very popular, it's like you're reading. The thing about Israel is when they kill a Palestinian, it goes viral. I mean, people eat it up. There was a very interesting observation. I mean, this will kind of shock you. In the Breaking the Silence, the Israeli former soldiers who report on what goes on during these massacres, there was one fellow who was speaking, and he said, when we come back from combat, when we come back, even though it's not even combat, as you know, it's just shooting fish in a barrel, but when we come back, our girlfriends, they always ask, did you kill an Arab? And you would think they were asking it in the, like, you didn't kill an Arab. He said, they're waiting for us to say yes. That's a kind of mark of our manliness. If you answer, oh, great, you killed an Arab, which is like, were you at the lynching? You know, because lynchings are very popular. Did you torch the body? Did you get one of the body parts? Because they used to auction off the body parts after the lynchings. Oh, yeah. It was very ugly. Then they would have pictures of you holding the body part, and they were used the pitch as postcards. That's Israel today. I mean, what do you say about a country where the snipers along the fence, they look for a kid 600 meters away. 600 meters away. He's doing nothing. They kill him, or because Israel is sensitive to public opinion, they're very careful. You kill a certain number, what you call, you might call the absorptive capacity of public opinion. They'll accept a certain number, and then they target the kneecaps. They target the kneecaps to kill the kid's life. Because if you're an amputee in Gaza, you're disabled for life, your life is over. No woman's going to marry you. You'll never have a family. You'll never find a job. And they're doing, they're aiming for the kneecaps, which is murder. It's murder in another way, but it's still murder. You're murdering the person's life. The person's life is over. Do you know how many people they targeted who were had their bicycles because they were championship runners or soccer players, and they targeted them? You know what it means to the kid? His one way out of Gaza is as a cyclist, as a football player, and they target them. And they're proud of it. It's a very ugly place. But where I can't agree with Abdin, and it's not a point where we should get into an argument, you know, I don't think it's all reducible to Zionism. That place has become a concentration of everything that's ugly in imperialism, colonialism, the ugly aspects of this Jewish chosenness, this Jewish superiority, this Jewish kind of ubermenschen, we're superior. It's a concentration of all the ugliest features of Israel as a project and of the Jewish people, I'm sorry to say. I mean, there are wonderful things about the Jewish people which any sane person would, you know, revel in. Not only if you're not Jewish, Jewish whatever, you know. You take pride in it. But there are aspects which are really ugly, and they've taken such a concentrated form in the state of Israel at this point. But let's be honest. Everything I just said, you could have said about Germany in the 1930s. Had many redemptive features in art, in philosophy, in every field, natural sciences, in every field of endeavor. But there were ugly aspects of that history, German history. And in the 1930s, the redemptive features were completely effaced, and it became this concentration of everything decadent, everything depraved, not just in German history, but in Western history, and maybe you could say even human history. It became a concentration of everything decadent and depraved. Did that make Germany beyond redemption? No, it's a very decent place right now. So we can acknowledge many aspects went into creating the state of Israel. A lot of them were very ugly. We should call out the ugly, but I'm not willing, because I don't think history gives me the grant, to say it's all about Zionism and it all has to be eliminated. I it doesn't make sense to me.
Abdin, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you your final thoughts on this.
Well, I want to end on a positive note. And the positive note is that I think that the Trump administration and the Zionist Organization of America was a outlier in the Jewish community until Trump came into office. Zionist Organization of America now has been empowered, and they're now driving a lot of this stuff. Now we're in a situation where these uber Zionists can be exposed because they're overstepping. They're encroaching on the most basic rights of Americans in a way that they had not done before. That is the issue that's at hand now. And we have to seize this moment to advance the tremendous strides. If somebody told me 5 years ago that the whole issue of BDS would be where it is today, I would have said they were crazy. It has been proceeding by leaps and bounds. If somebody had told me that the whole business about anti-Zionism would be where it is today 5 years ago, I would say they were out of their mind. it has been proceeding leaps and bounds. Many, many young people say, I'm not a Zionist. I'm Jewish, but I'm not a Zionist. So that is an important thing, and we have to deepen and strengthen that whole movement.
I don't even think, to be perfectly honest, for somebody like Jared Kushner, he doesn't care about Zionism. He cares about Zionism as much as MBS cares about Islam. No, it's true. Jared, it's just real estate developing. He never cared about resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict. He cared about a relationship with MBS that was going to turn the whole of the Gulf into his new playground to build skyscrapers. They don't care about Zionism. I doubt Jared Kushner has a clue what Zionism is. They're Jewish supremacists, that I'm sure of, because I know the type. They're Jewish supremacists. I wouldn't even, as I've said already, I wouldn't bring in the Zionism issue. These people think they're better. They have this entitlement. The Palestinian life just doesn't count. It's not important to them. Just as a lot of subhuman people's lives don't count. They're not Jews. So for me, it's less an ideological issue as it is a component of Jewish thinking, just like it was a component of German thinking. Abdin mentions Deutschland über alles, but the Germans called themselves Übermenschen. They were supermen. Right. And then there are the Untermenschen, the subhumans. And that's Jared Kushner, the entitled Übermenschen. The one difference is, there are a lot of very smart Jews. He's not one of them. He's a twit. He got into Harvard because the year he applied to Harvard, his father gave Harvard $2.3 million. Everybody at his school, all of his counselors, all of his co-students said he didn't have the grades, he didn't have the SAT scores, he had no business being in Harvard. It's just daddy bought his way into it. So he's you might call him an Unter-Übermensch, a very low Übermensch. Other than that, I think Abdin and I are more or less on the same page, which is, you know, nice. We go back too far into the past, as old as Methuselah at this point. And I'm hopeful. I think the key point, as Abdin has already said and I said, is they overstepped this time.
Abdin Jabbar and Norman Finkelstein, thank you both for being on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.